Hey, Ben. Glad to be back.
One of the interesting things about our discussions is that it leads to other things happening. You're talking with Scott Woods about particularly your ideas about rock music and rock criticism, and I do my late lunch shows, and what you say to me feeds into those. And at the moment we've got I'm particularly excited because there's a reading of Aesthetics of Rock by Richard Meltzer, which you've been doing, which I completely agreed with. I it's kind of that thing where it reminds me of what I originally thought before I got confused by the general opinions around me. It's a restoration of my radical modernism, of my belief that Blast is the most important book of the 20th century, that I agree with absolute abstraction and getting rid of the trivial tinsel that we're surrounded by. It reminds me of that because, and the frustrating thing I had, and this is why these frustrations are little elements which spin out and get ignored, but it's interesting to grab hold of them and bring them back in and make them the centre of something else, in the way that you can take a little piece of crystal and grow another crystal. And so what I wanted to read to you is the conclusion to my last Late Lunch Without a Lunch show, which I couldn't deliver because I was 30 seconds over, I had another 30 seconds, and somebody from upstairs in the Resonance studio switched on a jingle. So I couldn't say my conclusion. So I want to tell you my conclusion. I want to see if you find that a correct response to what you've been saying in your conversations with Scott Woods. Okay. My conclusion was, I called the whole program Output, partly because Wolfgang Dauner, the German keyboardist, did an amazing record called Output for ECM Records, which has been celebrated as an industrial record by people outside jazz, and has definitely not been favoured by the guy who recorded it, Manfred Eich, who put it out. It's an early ECM record, and it's not at all in the spirit of his later ECM kind of high-class music.
And I got the remark, you said he probably doesn't want to know that he did that.
He wants to forget about it. And it has a picture of a naked fat man who's hairy with his fingers, with electric wires attached to his fingers, and his head's been replaced by a gigantic light bulb. And it's called Output because it's about Wolfgang Dauner, this highly trained pianist, and he's playing a grand piano and a ring modulator and an electroclavinet all at the same time.
And that's in 1970?
It's in 1970. So he's dealing with the what you would call the electric environment.
Yeah, that's a McLuhan-esque cover. And McLuhan had a light bulb on the first issue of Understanding Media.
Yeah, and my feeling about the record is that there's something pure and beautiful about it because he's doing the one thing that he could do with these instruments and the confrontation with the grand piano. Therefore, it's essential. It's like there's a certain set of possibilities, a certain setup you have, and the art you should do is all you can do with it. It's not a matter of having your art as some kind of open space where different people go in and perform different things and you can have different opinions about. It's essential. So the conclusion I came to in this program, listening to Wolfgang Dauner, was that pertinent art is the necessary output of a particular setup and not some arbitrary clown drawn on the velvet with a great swanky signature beneath. In other words, we're in favour of objectivity, not celebrity.
Yes, you said substructure. Just say that pertinent art over sub. What was
The pertinent art is the necessary output of a particular setup. And it's because I believe there are so many particular setups that I don't believe we're only left with one artwork, because every setup requires its necessary output.
Yeah, I take what you mean as the setup is the ground, what I call the ground, the structure you're in and you want to see through or comment or celebrate or deny, and the pertinent art is the figure for that ground. So you're saying the figure-ground relationship there. That's the role of small A art.
But when you say, the funny thing is, it's small A art, and yet you needed to say the figure for the ground, because the Clown on Velvet, and it's a reference to a phrase used as a guitar solo title by Frank Zappa, and he explained it in an interview by saying, well, it's kind of what they do when they have people have a piece of black velvet, they go and paint a clown on it. And for me, that's the idea of having to fill up some space with a trite and obvious filler thing that you put in the space. And that I think that what we're, when you say the figure for the ground, you're not saying you can put any figure in there. There is one logical figure, which is something we've mentioned before, that we are heretics within the postmodern pluralistic world, because we are coming back to 20th century, early 20th century modernism, which wanted to get rid of the variety and return to some primal basic object that's necessary.
Yes, the idea that you're filling up a space, that's what you said, with the sentimental art of Clowns on Velvet. McLuhan said visual space, the Gutenberg effect, creates sentimentality in a fragmentation, and filling in visual space is a container. But the breakthrough of radical modernism, McLuhan said, is they realized each object created its own space. It wasn't fitting into a space. So that's what you mean. It's filler. Clowns on Velvet is a filler thing, whereas pertinent art is a probe, an object created resonating with the structure that's around you, the other object. Remember Zappa's, what was his phrase? Project slash object in the macro output structure, something like that. Remember that?
Well, he called what he was doing the output macro structure, or the project slash object, if you prefer.
Oh, yeah, right. So the point is, he's creating an object. He's not filling in space, he's creating a space.
And he's projecting. It's phallicism. I mean, this is very blast, isn't it? It's very vorticist. I mean, it's admitting you're projecting something out. And
yes,
most liberals are too tasteful about what happens in the nether regions to admit that.
And they want you, their larger aesthetic bias is they want you to fit in to the prescribed decorum of the substructure ground that created the liberalism attitude and dominance.
No, they don't want any bumps in the underpants.
Yes, and they want, like in the art schools today, they want you to fit into being a rebel in a prescribed way. You're supposed to be unique or different or autonomous, you know, assert your individual uniqueness. That's what they're taught in art school.
So now, one of the things you say about your version of McLuhan is nobody else has it, that it's unique, Bob, isn't it? I mean,
yes,
this is one of your claims. Now, to what extent is it the uniqueness that you've understood how he comes from understanding the revolutionary art of the early years of the 20th century?
Well, my colleague Don Thiel, who was McLuhan's first PhD in 1950 and actually brought McLuhan together with Carpenter, he was a very important person. He was only 22 when he did that. He spells this out in a book he did on McLuhan called The Medium is a Rearview Mirror. And I kind of knew it, but I read his book back in the early 70s, so I learned my lesson as he refined it. And then I always was in touch with him later. And then as I got to read McLuhan stuff, and nobody was reading the letters or the details of the essays and that he'd done, it's all spelled out. He's always talking about Lewis and the radical modernists. He even says it in interviews. So it's not hard to know if you just look a little bit into McLuhan. Now, there have been the next generation, Andrew Crystal, Schoeke in New York, her last name's Van de Meulen or something. They are, with my help and reading Thiel, they recognize that, and they're doing PhDs pointing this out. In other words, the baby boomer generation and older did not get it. I'm unique in that world.
But it's almost because they had to.
A few young kids are getting it.
If you're going to reconstitute a elite culture, you have to get rid of that radical modernist idea. You have to soften it. You have to know everything, obviously, because it's cool to know things. So you have to know all about early 20th century modernism. You know all about them. Yeah, you know these kind of things.
Yeah.
But you can't take the general, the approach that there is a primal communication in art which is not to do with you being educated to receive it, that it could speak directly to you, that you have to get rid of that because that's got in it a radical democratic idea. I mean, if abstract art, I mean, I remember this being just considered an absolute heretical idea in the structuralist environment of the education I received in the 70s, that you could have a natural communication. But when I read the theories of Kandinsky and Mondrian, all these artists thought they were doing a painting that did not rely upon cultural codes. They thought they were dealing with something built into nature and our bodies that people could respond to without being educated into it. And that was what interested in them. That's what art should pursue.
And maybe art was feeling that way because the electric environment had a more democratic impulse. The telegraph allowed the workers of the world to unite around Marx and Engels and these people, and it brought people together instantly. So then the artists would, by the 1900, 1910, would be inside what McLuhan called the emotion of multitude that was caused by the electronic simultaneous vortex, which reminds me, you mentioned Vortex Records on today's show. You know what I mean? You cite Vortex Records for one of the things you play. Did you notice that?
Not at all. There was Horror Records, not Vortex Records.
You said, near the end of the show, you said something about Vortex, and I thought maybe it was Vortex, some other company or publisher or something.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, well, I hallucinated. Anyway, the thing is, the artist moving out of the gallery, 100 years ago, and trying to communicate in the street to everybody, that was a democratic impulse that was post-Gutenberg. Electronic Marconi Galaxy allowed that, because the artist was for an elite in the 19th and 18th century, you say?
Yeah, absolutely, and if I could restate that within my Marxist terminology, I'd say that when is the possibility of the radical democracy of the people employed by capital taking capital over and using it for their own ends of controlling capital, that's just when artists no longer feel they have to appeal to a particular layer of the population, but that they could reach everybody. And beyond reaching everybody, I think they believe they can reach animals and rocks and the stars, that we could reintegrate what it is to be human and not have the splits between man and nature, which is a product of the bourgeois mindset.
Yeah, and part of at least the Vorticist movement was that technologies were part of nature. The futurists tried to do that, but it was in a bravado, mechanical knee-jerk way. Lewis and Joyce and Pound were more aesthetic or more sensitive to the dynamics of the new machines as new animals that they were communicating to, including nature. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm also, I find the Lewisian argument, I mean, looking at Blast, looking at the magazine, incredibly exciting and inspiring, and his Enemy of the Stars, the play he wrote in for Blast, electrifying. At the same time, I get a sensation that there's something a little artificial about the whole Vorticist production, that when I investigate Cubism or Dada or even Italian Futurism, Russian Futurism, these movements on the continent, the Bauhaus, I find them very rich and logical in their connection with society. And there's something a bit desperate about the vortex, a bit kind of like, well, we've got to invent a new thing, the vortex. I mean, it just seems to me it's never convinced me as a movement. It's always seemed like, well, everybody else is having a modernism. We'll have to kind of make one up here.
No, that's true. Now, here's McLuhan wrote a great review of Burroughs's Nova Express and Naked Lunch that I shared with Ian Patterson when I was there in April 2008. And in that review, you have that review, but if you read his letters, he writes a letter to his friend describing the assignment for writing that review. And he's reviewing Burroughs' stuff. And he says, Burroughs is not a very bright person. He is merely reacting rather than acting. Now, you have to figure out what he means by acting, because most reacting is considered acting. But anyways, he's saying Burroughs is merely reacting and not acting. McLuhan means acting as in a theatrical role player. McLuhan would probably say that Wyndham Lewis was reacting he was reacting, you know, a year or two behind to the futures now bit. And I think it's the reacting part that you find diminishes the vorticism, whereas the acting part is what you see in Bauhaus and Dadaism. They weren't reacting. They were creating their own spaces.
Yeah.
Lewis has the ideology of creating your own space, but he is forced to react because he's in the backwater, London.
Yeah.
And he's dragging the other guys, the Camden group, forward with him. And he was always, because he was on the outside, he's almost...
Yeah. Visible.
Like you in Wire magazine or something. It's like where you're... Well, maybe that's the way you are now. You sometimes are forced to react.
Yeah, well, it's because the only visible culture that he could have any relationship to was Bloomsbury, the Bloomsbury group, who are really the upper classes thinking that they can rule culture. That's what their Virginia Woolf and those people, the Bells and so on. It was the upper classes thinking that they can travel abroad, they can find out, they can read, they have all these facilities, they're wealthy. And the ownership that they felt they could have of being the importers of European modernism into Britain, they were so in control that Wyndham Lewis could kick them, but there wasn't anybody else, there was no other way of proceeding apart from in relationship to them. I mean, it's rather how I feel about modern music in London, that the only thing I can relate to is Wire magazine, so I keep kicking it. But in fact, it'd be much healthier if I could leave that aside and develop contacts with completely different people and forget that problem.
Yeah, then you're acting. You're aware subconsciously of your role and the space you're creating, but you are acting and then maybe forcing other people to react to that. Rather than just being reacting, that's the role of your radio show.
So there's a sense in Blast that is Wyndham Lewis really calling for a complete revolution of society, or is he saying here's a new style of painting that everyone can start buying? You know, we're never quite sure.
I think he was doing that. I think he was doing both. But you do the same thing. You say, hey, please buy me. I'm available. You said that, right?
Yeah, well, we always need resources, don't we, to develop what we want to do.
You could say that you're a bit upset at Lewis because, you know, they say when you were bothered by somebody, you're actually seeing an aspect of yourself in that person, which you don't like about yourself, so you think that person has it and you don't, but you're hiding that yourself has it. So you're actually not liking the fact you see yourself in Lewis.
Yeah, or I could see a sort of malaise in the English society that hasn't really changed a great deal since that period.
So he did that. But that's not all that he did. He moved on. He was always reacting, but he was an intelligent reactor. He was almost, by the time he's doing The Enemy in the late 20s, he's almost acting. You know what I mean? He's actually more conscious. He's changed. He's overcome the wounds from the war. He's retreated and done The Man of the World, 2,000-page manuscript, which broke up in those books he published in the late 20s. He's creating his own space, but it's pretty hard because there's nobody going for it. He remains so isolated, he has to leave the country.
He ends up in Canada, doesn't he?
Yeah, and then he meets McLuhan. He gets all excited working with McLuhan, but then he gets, because of his paranoia, he gets upset with McLuhan and sabotages everything and runs back to England under the excuse that his wife was really homesick, for England. But he really wanted to be accepted, you could say. He had to go back and refight the battle and make it this time, and he did. By 1950, the BBC is broadcasting the Children Mass. And he did get some kind of recognition, but at that point he's going blind.
Yeah, but he's also the ferocity and completeness of his early painting and his early writing gets kind of diluted. He does a lot of society portraits where his vorticist vision becomes a kind of style of scallops. You know, everything's in these kind of scallop shapes, these kind of pointy ovals, and it becomes a kind of stylistic device, like streamlining on a car or something, and he can do portraits like that. And his novels become more like conventional novels. They're not the brute headline, confrontation with objects and words in like his early stuff. So I always felt Wyndham Lewis, there's a decline in him as his success happens.
Well, what he was doing in the 30s was doing what you call in your book on Zappa, the corporate period. He's doing corporate rock.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, remember? Frank starts doing, quote, corporate rock in the late 70s. Well, that's to call those portraits Lewis's corporate period. He's trying to be acceptable. He's got no money, hassled. But what he does when after he comes out of Toronto and being with McLuhan St. Louis, he's a different person after the war. And he, as McLuhan said, an American cosmic man, 1948, he understands the global village before anybody. And he says the Europeans can't get it. They live in too many small city spaces. He actually is moving beyond everybody. And then what's the point in writing a novel in 1950? But he can't stop, so he writes his novels. And he also does pretty good, interesting painting in the later period. It's totally different. You can see that in Paul Edwards' book, the Yale thing came out in 2000 with all the later paintings, nice plates. It's interesting, and very interesting analysis by Paul and his gang of that later work. It's not as dramatic maybe as the 1914s, but the thing is that he is responding to the TV age. He's responding to a whole different dynamic that's going on. It's not the same Wyndham Lewis. It's a different structure. So he's doing pertinent art. And part of that, he becomes a critic on BBC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's an art reviewer, museum gallery attender. What was the phrase where we said pertinent art over a, you know, that thing in the last sentence of your show this morning?
Pertinent art is the necessary output of a particular setup.
A particular setup. Lewis is really... He's gone past Pound and Eliot. Joyce isn't around. He understands the world after 1945 probably better than anybody. And that's the book that really turns on McLuhan. He talks about it in one of his letters. He says, this is an incredible work. American Cosmic Man is published, and there's no reaction. Just thud, dud, dead, you know? McLuhan knew that Lewis was too in the present for anybody to deal with. Okay, now Lewis wasn't perfect, you know what I mean? I mean, he still had his opinions. He wrote a book in 54 called The Demon of Progress in the Arts, and that's where he's a little upset at the direction Francis Bacon and Jackson Pollock are taking it, but he actually has an interesting way of criticizing it. He has a system to criticize it. He's saying you're not responding to the present. It's art about art, but they were responding to the present, and McLuhan, almost, you can look at McLuhan's writings as a correction of Lewis's flaws.
Yeah.
He's an old guy. He's in there working on it. He's born in 82. He's 70 years old, and that's old back in those days, and he's there fighting it on BBC, taking on the new stuff, always keeping up on what's going on, just like you do. You tune in to what's happening and take a stance in response to it.
Well, one tries, but at the same time, I mean, one of the things that has always made me wince is watching, there's a particular rock critic, I don't know if you're aware of him, called Simon Friss.
Oh, yeah, he's the main guy who has the books in the big bookstores. I've seen his books.
Yeah. And
he's a professor, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a professor. And yeah. He's also...
he's your Grail Marcus.
Yeah, he gets involved with the... I mean, Grail Marcus, I disagree with Grail Marcus for all sorts of reasons. I think he's a literary fellow trapped in having to write about rock records.
I look at Simon Frith's books. I look at them and I say, this is ridiculous. Like, I can't read them.
Exactly. I mean, Grail Marcus can... that's what I was going on to say. Grail Marcus can actually write. Simon Frith can't write. He's a sociologist and an academic. And he's kind of stilted. He can't name his books. He can't really string a sentence together. But he's got this position of enthusiasm for pop music, which was authentic, I think, when he was a teenager and in his early 20s. But he carries on saluting each new
teen fad.
Each new teen fad. Each acceptable something that can fit an adult mindset just about and still appeal to the teen. Whereas if you understand your Frank Zappa, you know that the strength of rock music is not appealing to the adult mindset at all. It insults it. The offensive part of the way that rock offends your intelligence is its intelligence. That's what is different from your set of concepts. That's what stretches you, which is why Frank was always harking on about Louie, Louie. This completely stupid song has been the heart of what rock music is. And Fritz doesn't understand that. He thinks that he can somehow bridge the gap between the educated mind and rock music. And
that's ridiculous.
But he ends up
anti-thinking, basically.
But he ends up always claiming that he's responding to the latest thing which the youth are enthusing with. And when I was younger, I always liked cantankerous old gits, you know, because I sensed something honest about them. Even if they were dissing me and completely disagreeing with all the things I loved, I knew that they were speaking from the heart, you know, that there was something real in them. And I remember somebody contrasting Adorno and Marcuse when they were played the Rolling Stones, that Marcuse went, yeah, it's great, it's all part of the revolution. And Adorno actually listened to it and started arguing about it with the students. And I like Adorno's position. I like the position of being antagonistic and being honest about your responses and trusting that that honesty, that refusing to collude or be smooth or to try and ingratiate yourself with younger people, will be respected by the most intelligent younger people, and therefore you will be able to communicate with them. How do you feel about that?
I agree to. I missed the last one. You're saying the intelligent people, they would be turned off at some adult trying to agree with them?
Yeah.
Is that what you just said?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, because what we want is a... what I'm interested in reaching is a meta position, a philosophical position, in which I can see myself as an object working. But to do that, I've got to not lie about my immediate... I'm not... To get universal, you need dialogue with people. And to pretend to universality before you've had a disagreement with someone is, in fact, to be smug and scheming.
That's right. Our life is a disagreement. That's the ongoing dialectic.
Yeah.
You can't deny that. And you know, that's what's so flaky about New Age thinking, that you must overcome the struggle or pain of dialectic disagreement by a positive attitude or patina of smiliness or something.
Silly. I mean, what the problem with dialectic is that people are unused to actually doing more than being polite to agree with each other and swallowing disagreements. And so when disagreements come up, they often take it so seriously they think there's a war on and that they can't talk to anybody anymore. And so actually splits appear and you can't carry on the dialogue. Now, I'm against that. I'm looking for some kind of way of being able to have an honest disagreement with somebody, but in a way that doesn't stop the dialogue.
Right. We don't even address the New Agers, that's silly. But those that agree that life is a struggle and dialectic interaction understand that. Our input is, you guys are dialectalizing about the wrong limited rearview mirror stuff. You're not even in dialecticing with the present. That's what you mean. You mean they're not dialecticalizing. They recognize that's what life is or interaction is. They're not doing the present. They're arguing about something past, and then they realize, then they get into sects or different divisions and can't talk to each other. That's interesting, that you have a dialectical dogma about the world, and then you still become undialectical as a result of it. So that's why even spelling out the dialectical reality is not the definition of what you have to do. You can't say what you have to do to stay alive and really, capital D or small d, whichever is more important, dialectical. You know what I mean? Like, we are being dialectical, and we're including Finney's Wake, and there's not anybody in the world that would include Finney's Wake in this situation, you know, in the Socialist Labor Party or the neocon world. But we're saying that's the dialectic you got to deal with. Well, that's what we're dealing with, and we're on the radio, and you're not.
And it's the sound of what you're saying in the ear of someone who hasn't heard you right, but is going to reply anyway?
Mm. Is that what we're doing?
I don't know. Is that what Finnegan's Wake is? If it's the sound.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Do that again. The sound of someone. Say that again.
Are we demanding that people respond to us whether or not they understand what we're saying because we think we're mobilizing a music of the body that communicates or doesn't communicate, and that people could respond to how we're talking to each other on an instinctual level, which would understand the degree of emotional dance being perpetrated by these voices that they'll hear?
That is part B. I'm saying you need to engage with this book for 10 minutes. You need to think about it. You're not going to have an appropriate response till you engage with it, and then we could help you see it. Then you get the conceptual, kind of conceptual point of it. Then you can start doing the phatic mind.
But the concepts have to be formed by the reader. They're not in the book. That the work of the book is a rhythmic and sonic massage, which is deliberately aimed to crack the concepts that you bring to bear on it and make them move.
Exactly. This is actually the difference and similarity in a way between you and me, is that I use the 10 Thunders of Finney's Wake to explain the technological history and show how Joyce does it to give someone a conceptual way to enter the wake. You represent part two, phase two, where once, and you have looked at the Finney's Wake conceptually, you've read the creation, you know the conceptual part, but you stand by and emphasize phase two, where you mind the thing in pure formal sound dynamics. I say they can't become Ben until they understand Bob.
Yeah, I agree. You are a first stage, but I think part of what your rhetoric does, particularly in a highly technological society, I mean, I think it's, you know, it has to do with where you've talked most and who you've convinced with, that in order for Finnegan's Wake to even be looked at, you can't play the card of saying, well, it's great literature. Because everyone will say, well, what's great literature? You've got to play the card of saying this is about the future. That if you are investing money or you're wondering which job to do, you've got to understand where society's going. You can't understand it without Finnegan's Wake. Now, that, in your environment, is going to make people take it seriously. So in a way, we're strategic, aren't we? I mean, I'll use great literature, you use that. Both of us are just being strategic about who's around us because we want to get their noses into that book because we don't know what they'll say when they emerge from it. That's why we want them to read the book.
That's the dialectical. Yeah, that's the surprising part. We know that something interesting will come out of it.
And people will get confused if they think that our gambits to get the people around us to look at the book are our interpretation. Because they'll say, but Bob and Ben, you have completely different ideas of this book. Well, the reason we have different ideas is simply we've had to argue differently to get people to look at it. But all the time, what we're really watching is that reaction that people have and the discoveries they make. Every time I've ever managed to get somebody to actually look at it, they've always found things in it which have told me more about them than I could have got by asking them direct questions.
Yeah, it's the original Rorschach ink blot that brings out a person. What they project around them is right there. That's, you see, any major progress in psychological therapy or sociological therapy, it's all been done and is being done and updated by the Wake. He did it first.
Yeah.
Or he wrapped it all up or somehow, whatever you say. He did it.
Yeah.
But that's exactly it. We have trained ourselves with different audiences to spark their interest, to dupe them. Like, you know, McLuhan said to the kids, this is about LSD, this is LSD, this is television. Well, I say this is the internet, you know, it's a later phase, so I say it's that, and then try to prove it. And you can prove it, not just because you can put anything into the wake, that there is a technological stratum in the wake. You can't deny statements like television kills telephony and brothers broil. The eyes demand their turn, let them be seen. That's an incredible statement there on page 52. That's so packed with implications. It also doesn't refer to television. It also means tell a vision, whatever your epiphany is or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what's a phony? To tell a lie. Television, he's not saying, he's not positing truth versus phony lying. He's saying a vision versus phony. That's an interesting dialectic there, right?
And you could handle all this technology and keep your critical mind and your creative mind alive in dealing with all these extensions and prostheses that humans have invented, if you keep going an honest appraisal of what the human animal is. And I think that's what is anchoring Joyce into being able to keep mashing up concepts, technologies, ideas sort of come through him, and he's able to throw it back because of this anthropological certainty he has.
Well, he understands, as McLuhan said about Joyce, he would wait patiently for the slips of tongue or the gaffes in conversation. He knew they would show up. He knew the living synchronicity of life, or whatever you want to call it, and he would wait and then jot them down. He knew that life would perform for him and give him his material. That's a really, you know, comprehensive, attentive faculty that any great artist has, or any great scientist, or any great janitor has. They have the attention to the present complex, which is not limited to just the now.
Yeah, that's a good way of describing why Danny Houston and Gamma mean as much to me as Finnegan's Wake, because this thing of noticing what's actually under your nose is it's funny, because in some ways you could quote artists saying that again and again in so many different ways, but nobody gets it to the point of actually acting on it. You know, the repeating of it, you know, see as a child and everything, you kind of want to shoot yourself, you hear it so often.
That's right. The actual, I mean, there's this guy, Eric Tolle or something, who writes about living in the present. And he was on Oprah Winfrey and made very popular in the New Age world.
All right.
Because he's describing living in the now, but if you listen to him, his voice, audiobooks, he'll drive you to sleep. And I actually, Ion told me that the real popularity of Tolle's books is that people have used them to fall asleep at night, because he talks in a monotone.
Now, is
that's
this
the only reason he's big?
Is this? I remember when I first spoke to Jerry Fiolka, who is the first person I heard of who I heard of you first from Jerry, and I remember explaining my basic philosophy of Finnegan's Wake plus Frank Zappa to him about paying attention to what's actually under your nose, and he said, sure, that's like wake up and smell the coffee. And I remember like being completely crestfallen that my whole kind of serious and extreme criticism of the world could be reduced to such a phrase, you know.
That's interesting, because, you know, I don't know if we could say that there's more advertising in the States, more PR culture than in Britain. Maybe not, but we're talking 15 years ago when you said that to him. But either it's Jerry's dimness in that case, don't want to say he's always dim, but his dimness in that case, and he thought that's what you meant, but I'm giving him the benefit of doubt, and that was being ironic, because wake up and smell a coffee, the Android meme says that, and Mr. Toll, they tell you to live in the moment, but the moment has changed. And the moment, the technological replay of the present, which contains all times and spaces due to recording technology, that very issue is what McLuhan was tackling. He says, that's the new drug, living in the moment. Actually, Android Beam gives you the artistic sensibility right back at you. And how do you respond to that? Because that's a bit of a pseudo-environment. And so he said the wake was the beginning of really perceiving how all times are happening, not as an icon or a New Age platitude or an advertising logo, but can you perceive why Joyce was being exactly correct in writing a book in that way? It's the only proper response to the 1930s, is to write a book like that.
Yeah, and one of the things going on in the book in terms of the politics of the English language is a continual desecration of the high Latinate end of the language in favour of the Anglo-Saxon and the Scandinavian. That abstractions and words that end in -ation are only ever introduced with a complete sense of mockery. And this is to do with the church's control of power, and the fact that if you speak Latin in the country, and partly to do with the Norman invasion, so that the top class people are talking French, which is more closely related with Latin, but also the fact that the ruling classes are ruling in Latin. That's their language of communication with each other and with ruling classes in Europe and the Pope and so on. And throughout Finnegan's wake, there is a relishing of the local dialect and the kind of sounds which the person who speaks good Latin or speaks received pronunciation English finds grotesque and provincial. That there's this support, there's a negative dialectic in it, a support for something undiminished by distinction or undiminished
by good taste.
It's
like Alan Lomax when he went and recorded all the blues guys in the 30s, or the later Harry Smith, was it? They went and found the ignored.
Yeah. Well, absolutely, Alan Lomax. I mean, the politics of the tape recorder as one of the things which produced the whole 60s culture of revolution is to do with the fact of documenting oral voices which had previously required were incredibly edited by institutions. I mean, you know, the first black music that got out was kind of gospel and its fundraising for an institution. So Queen Victoria heard the Jubilee singers, but to actually go with a tape recorder and to get the actual voices of people in the South and in apartheid conditions and allow them to tell their story, you're producing a kind of a total reversal of what the idea of culture is. I mean, the literary idea of culture, which is derived from the religious idea of culture, is that we have the book and you must you're educated insofar as you learn this book, which we have, and if you are humble enough and study hard enough, you can aspire to the book. But here somebody's going and taking this machinery and recording directly what people are saying and singing and producing that as a culture. Well, yeah, I mean, that turns everything upside down.
Yeah, you could say that Finnegan's Wake is Alan Lomax in print. Lomax continued the Joycean approach.
Yeah.
By going around and recording the marginal or whatever, the forgotten, the hidden, the cliché.
Yeah.
The cliché, not in terms of mainstream cliché, but the hidden clichés.
Yeah.
So
you say to me that you skip the parts in my radio shows if I read out Finnegan's Wake, but for me, my way of understanding the Wake is of a transcription of a babble of voices and a kind of a Joycean thread worming its way through and imitating this voice and that voice. I mean, I think he actually keeps together his own drama and drive of a single voice. I don't think it's you could achieve a Finnegan's Wake by a mechanical folding. There are many people, and I think Kenny Goldsmith is the most recent in this line of kind of pseudo-avant-gardes, who think via mechanical means they can copy what the real avant-gardists are doing and sort of produce a kind of book that's just as incomprehensible as Finnegan's Wake, but is actually not worth reading. And I think a folding simply of a lot of different books that you might produce wouldn't have what Finnegan's Wake has, which is this winding around and copying all these different voices, but it's like a performance by an incredible mimic, a Lord Buckley or somebody who can, all these different voices can enter into this person, but it's still one person performing this incredible show off, this incredible bunch of fireworks going off.
Yes. I want to say that it's not that I leave you reading Finn's Wagon Show. I listen to the Sun Ra, then I'm interested in your comment, because your shows for me are an update of Alan Lomax. I'm interested in what you found in your media experience, or immediate media and on the street experience. So you're using the Joycean method, and I'm interested in what you say about it. So when you have feature Sun Ra, I can hear a bit of it. Okay, I know that, but I want to hear what Ben says. And then what else does he put in there in the show? So you're actually updating your method of doing radio is Joycean and Alan Lomaxian.
Those are, I'm very flattered to be described
like that. Regina, Saskatchewan, you know, wherever you
are. Yeah, and the commentary is, it is quite amazing how much mainstream radio there is with these blocks of, I mean, you know, I'd say about a third of pop music that I hear on the radio I think is pretty interesting. I think it's worth having heard. I'm not so avant-garde. I just think the whole thing is, you know, a waste of time. But what's depressing about it is that nobody ever comments on what they've played. I mean, they never talk about it.
Yeah.
It's never talked about. It's just sort of played as obviously great, but there's no response to it. It's not.
That's right.
It's not looked at.
Some of the stations when I was in New York, they didn't even say who they played.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if that's common, but in New York stations, they would just play music and not say who they played. Almost was like illegal. You don't even name who you just had content for your station that you make money with, you know? So anyways, I look at, I may not be interested in hearing you do Finnegan's Wake. I've done Finnegan's Wake. Talked to it, yacked at it, you know, and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to hear what the Finnegans are doing today. And you're a Finnegan. And you're redoing the Joycean Lewis approach to what you find. So, you know, you're to me, what you present is more interesting than Finney's Wake to me.
Well, the fact of the mini-disc recorder, which is a digital quality recorder of very small size that you can take around with you, and you can put microphones, very good microphones, in your ears so that people think that you're listening to headphones. They think you're listening to something when you're in fact recording them. So you don't have the self-consciousness induced by sticking a great big microphone under people's noses.
That's great.
That piece of technology is fantastic, and it was Ian Stonehouse who first alerted me to that and went out doing recordings. And his response to getting a mini disc and this setup was simply to go out walking in London. And he had a little bit of him walking into a cafe, what we call a greasy spoon or a greasy in London, where you get a traditional English breakfast, and the sound of frying that he got from there I use for the opening of the album Frankfurter Ahnung, and for me is pertinent art because it was the necessary output of a particular setup. That once you've got this ability to record, somehow everything he did was absolutely magical that Ian did, because he was doing the correct thing for the new technology of transcription. And these moments open up, and if you act on them, you produce something which has this this kind of elevated sense that nothing can go wrong, and everything that goes wrong even makes it better.
That's right. Now let me say this, is that and when I read Phineas Wake, there's always an impatience. What the hell am I reading this for? It's ridiculous. I have the same response to you. I listen to your show and I say, is Ben going to do that stupid stuff with Iris and Mordecai Gain and mouth off Ken Fox? Like, yeah, he's doing it, but maybe he's got something else here. It's always a slight impatience with this, but I don't even... You're honored because I will be impatient with your stuff. The other stuff, I'm not even going to engage and determine whether I'm patient or not. You know what I mean?
So I mean, I think a certain frustration and irritation is necessary in artwork.
In the engagement.
I mean,
it's,
you know,
like a conversation. As I'm not, you know, really frustrated right now, but I'm paying attention. I'm not totally relaxed, and I'm thinking my responses to what you're saying. There's a tension involved, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, we're doing these discussions of Marx and McLuhan over the oeuvre of Frank Zappa, and the absolute king of annoyingness has to be Frank Zappa. I mean,
and
you know,
and Karl Marx, and Wyndham Lewis, and me and you, we're annoying.
Annoying, yeah. Annoying's good. Annoying's talking.
But you can't be the formulaic version of annoying all the time. You have to come up with new ways of being annoying, and one of the ways is to fake a sunny disposition.
Yeah, that's true.
Like you say, I'm a nice guy. You said, but I'm a wonderful person. I'm a nice person. Yeah, up to a point, Ben. Then you'll turn on them. You'll become annoying on another level.
Yeah.
We're on to you, Ben.
And we have to keep annoying at that leg. You know, it's annoying. It's animals annoying.
Good pun. Yeah, good pun. I mean, anointment.
Yeah, anointment. Yeah.
Anointment.
Yes. Froth anointment.
2 minutes? 3 minutes?
Yeah, we've got 5 minutes.
Okay, so I want to address something that you emailed me. You say, your word for philosophy, Bob, is McLuhan. McLuhan quote. But others have thought about this stuff. Ianku. Who's Ianku?
I'm talking about Dumitrescu. That's his first name. Ianku Dumitrescu.
I actually thought it was Dumitrescu, but I couldn't. Yeah. I didn't look it up. And I said, well, yeah, maybe that's... Anyway, so, yeah. And then you put Hegel and Adorno. You go back 200 years. Ianku and Hegel. Call it phenomenology. Let's figure out what phenomenology is, because McLuhan said, when he was compared to Barth, he said, Barth's a phenomenologist. I could be considered a phenomenologist, but I do not relate my phenomenology with the concepts of prevalent theories of the time. So he liked to present himself as just dealing with percepts, not concepts. Now, he did say once that concepts are necessary for help people get a grip on what's going on. So he knew concepts was implied, but he emphasized percepts. Does phenomenology emphasize percept?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, phenomenology is noticing the specific and studying what's in front of your nose. I mean, it goes out from the phenomenon. It goes out from your response to it. So it takes seriously. And this is why artists are particularly fond of it, because instead of bullying you with moral systems or philosophical systems or ideal solutions, it's a philosophy of paying attention to the actual detail.
Okay, so you say others have thought about this. That's the problem. They think about this stuff. Academics conceptualize, write books about phenomenology, and they get bogged down in that medium. I don't think about the present. I'm responding. I don't know why I would limit it to think. I don't actually have that much conceptual baggage unless someone reminds me of it. So that's the point. McLuhan was not thinking about the present. He said nothing is inevitable if you're willing to contemplate what's happening. Many people would say, if you're willing to think about what's happening.
Contemplate.
And contemplation is a juxtaposition of percept and concept.
I have to say, I like hearing you crow about having catapulted yourself into the active world of everyday discussion. But when you catapult yourself, there's usually a lot of thongs have been stretched to give you the push to move the piece of wood that goes up to throw you away from where you were before and into something new. And I'm talking about Hegel and Adorno as part of the rubber band of the catapult, if you see what I mean. That these are the kind of thinkers which that eject revolutionaries. Or rather, to go back to our original thing about the project object, which project revolutionaries forward into the world.
Yeah, you and I are this is the final world championship of two champion annoyers, annoying each other. Okay,
yeah.
That's what's going on here. And so we have different ways of annoying each other, and I ran out.
Annoying without ignoring.
That's right, good point. And then I remembered, so when I say I'm the greatest thing, I actually believe it, but I also know it has an annoying practicality too. So we're creating spaces as annoyance, not trying to fit in, though we will fit in when necessary so we can lead to other ways of being annoying. You can't be formulaic in being annoying. And that's what I meant about the art schools. They teach kids, this is a way you can be annoying. You know, being independent or whatever POMO stuff they're taught. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's not the way to be. You can't teach somebody how to be annoying. They just have to be alive. How do you make them be alive? I don't know. But we'll challenge them. We'll pretend we're dead. I pretend I'm dead.
Well, the only way to make people be alive is to be alive yourself, is to cultivate that aliveness.
You actually don't have to do anything. You're infectious. And there will be people who will pick up on the virus. So that's who we're talking to.
Yeah,
we're trying to organize them.
Yes, we're talking to you. So is there any way anyone can get in touch with us? Yes. Go and delve. Find us.
Yes, but they can email me at purple@fivebodied.com.
Okay, you get them first. Send me the good ones.
Yes, I will pass them. I'll be the secretary. You be the grey eminence.
Yes, okay. Well, this eminence grise is calling an end to this discussion because we've reached our time limit. Thanks a lot, Bob. Any last bon mot?
Well, that's annoying that we have to stop.
It is, isn't it? Bye.